Here follows a true and accurate transcript of the words spoken by Sister Mara Clare, martyr. Sister Clare was bound, blindfolded, and questioned by those whose faith she did not know, yet at her trial the captive bound her captors with the power of her voice. Her words were set down by three master scribes who were summoned to witness and record her testimony. The precision of these transcripts is matching and exact. Part 1. In answer to the question, for what treason do we hold you here accountable? Wars have been fought over the small threads of detail that wind through the tapestry that forms the history of Wayland. Betrothals have been broken, friendships sacrificed, kingdoms toppled, and thrones emptied and filled. Duels and fistfights are, even now, in the present age, not uncommon. Yes, even now the history of Wayland is a serious subject throughout the Tri-Realm. But it becomes deadly serious once a body is south of the Deimos Hills, west of the mountains, and north of the Sandy Waste. Within the ancestral borders of Wayland, the wary visitor keeps a steady and cautious guard on the tongue. The wrong word spoken to the wrong person might be the last. The best and most commonly given advice when one is heading for this country is, better silent than silenced. And that means, of course, talking too much can really get you killed on a visit to Wayland. And here I am. Naturally, all the argument is about times long past. Since the days of King Raiden, events have been recorded with perfect accuracy. Everyone agrees about this, and I agree about it even more than everyone else. The glorious Tri-Realm values honest records. There is no deception in this government. So, my testimony will involve the events of ancient history. All my stories are about the warrior King Wei and his spotless dove. I will begin at the beginning because the problems start with the first words of any story. You see, there is a dispute about the relationship of Wei to the spotless dove. The monks of the Brotherhood record she is his daughter. They have the largest following, and I am one of their sisters, so, if I may be allowed, I will tell their stories first. Second to them, the Pythos say she was his wife or lover. I would tell theirs second. And finally, some few believe that she was his betrothed, traveling from a distant land over the mountains to die by his cruelty. But although the believers of this version are few, they are the most serious and the most deadly. They call themselves the Doveborn, and they are murderous in passion for their faith. I will tell their version at the last. The first story, if I may, I will tell as my mother told it to me. This is a fuller version than officially endorsed by the monks, but I trust that my mother knew the story well, and I am her daughter. I speak her words. The Wei Scream. Once, long ago, before the days that men were set as kings and ruled the land, the girl Mara found a stranger lying in a field. She was chasing the sow back to pen when she stumbled over his body. He was so cold and still she knew he was dead. But by the time she'd run back to the hut and brought her father to see, the man had grown warm. And by the time that other men had been sent for and the man was carried to the village, he was warmer still and breathing. They laid him on a pallet in the witch's hut, and then he was almost awake. His eyes were closed, but he mumbled strange words. Still, he'd been too cold for life, and Mara knew it. From that day, she feared him. At first openly, and then deep in her soul, hidden from him, almost hidden from herself. He had been, as she described to her father, winter cold, and the fact that he lived was a lie. She was sure of it. He was something not living. No man could grow so cold and live. Yet he was a man, whether he lived or not, and the only woman he wanted was the one who feared him. He lived his life, once he began to live it, to win the heart of Mara, and for some time she lived her life to guard her heart from him. It was a strange war of fire and ice. Her heart was colder toward him than her memory of his frozen skin beneath her fingers. It took the fire of dragon-burned croplands to warm Mara's heart, and then, when in time the heart of the man in its turn grew cold and love's war waged once again, the battle ended a second time by fire. So it was, a love born of fire and ice, and love's death by fire and ice. But I have left the story. Let us return to the man babbling in the witch's hut. His words had no meaning, and yet he spoke them like a rushing river, never ceasing. When he was awake, he babbled and looked deeply into the eyes of any who came near him. He babbled earnestly. He wept. When he was asleep, he mumbled. The words never stopped, but he never uttered a single sound with meaning. The witch looked after him, at first with wonder and pity, and then with a mother's love. She had lost a son to the frozen winter, and this man was to her that son regained. Never mind that he was tall and fair, and her lost boy had been small and dark. Truth didn't matter. The witch took this man as if he were her son, and she dribbled water and broth and whey mixed with honey into his babbling mouth until he was strong enough to eat. Then she fed him easy food until he was strong enough to stand. The day came, a mid-afternoon in late autumn, when he rose from the pallet where he lay. The witch said that he stumbled as he walked to the threshold of her hut, but he regained his footing and walked more careful and more sure until he pushed aside the blanket and stood within the door frame. Many villagers saw him standing there, looking around, slowly, at each and every hut, at each and every person, and then up at the sky. He was clothed with only a draping cloth, and his skin was pale and pasty. They say that for many years to come it turned red like a small child when it was struck by summer sun, but even he, pale as he was, grew paler. Slowly his eyes took in the village. My mother always said that as he stood outside the witch's hut and looked around the world, his skin may have begun to burn in even the autumn sunshine, but she had been told that his eyes blackened to darkness in what appeared to be terror until he fell to his knees, threw back his head, and screamed. Even the sky shivered and chilled with the power of that scream, and snow began to fall from the fast-frozen clouds. It was a scream like none had ever heard before, and I believe that it echoes still and can be heard every year at the moment just before the first snowfall, if a person opens the heart to hear. After that scream, the man stopped talking. He listened. He listened with such power that it seemed he soaked the words from another's mouth into his own soul. By the time the deep snows of winter came, he spoke true words, halting and misshapen, as though his mouth could only speak the frozen language of the dead, and the warm words of the living didn't fit somehow, but he spoke, and the people understood him. His first true words were spoken to Mara at midwinter. He asked for wine. Then, as now, if a boy asks a girl for wine at a midwinter feast, he is asking for much more than the words he says. This man asked Mara to bring him wine, and she refused. They say he looked so fierce and terrible at her answer that those around were frightened for her, but then he laughed. A great, booming laugh, the first laughter from him that any had ever heard, and the people laughed with him. After that night, he became a man of the village, and he went on the hunts with the others, and at the feast of his first kill, he took the name of Wei. Then I'll give you a little glimpse of the second story, Seffin. The Wei Song. There are few now who can still recite the Wei Song from memory. It is a hard task to learn, and the execution, once one has learned it, takes 3 fire nights, with the first word spoken as the tinder is struck, and the last into the dying embers. Women are not allowed to learn to sing that song, and so I will testify here that I do not know it. I never spent the weeks that turned to months crouched in a hermit's hovel, tending his fire, frying his fish, and pouring his wine while he chanted and repeated, hour after hour, tones I could never hope to sing aloud. That did not happen. But, like most sisters, I have heard the song performed, and I can set out the basic shape of its story in a simple form, and I will tell that story now. After Mara's rejection, the man laughed. He truly laughed. There was no malice. Then he stood, picked up a gourd, and dipped his wine himself. He closed an eye for just one blink at Mara as he drank, and though no one understood then what he meant by such a gesture, yet Mara blushed. The night wore on, and the men all slept around the fire, and he slept also. The fire burned low, the world was dark. This was in the early hours before the sun had cast its beams over the horizon, cast those first beams of sun that fall like feeling fingertips, the fingertips the sun would use to grip the earth and pull it upward toward the sky, before these fell. The man woke and rose with the other men as they left the fire to hunt. They hunted boar.